Nothing is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. And today we've got another Nothing is Real guest joining us in the Beatles pod, the one and only Mr. Kevin Godley. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're doing very well. Now, listeners, on the very slim chance you're unaware of the body of work of our guest today, Kevin Godley has been weaving his way in and out of all the best parts of popular culture for over 50 years. Whether it's as a quarter of 10cc or half of Godley and Cream, he's also been the man behind some iconic music videos for U2, Duran Duran, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, as well as up-and-comers George Harrison, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, and together as the Beatles. Amazingly, it has taken until 2020 for Kevin to release his debut solo album, Muscle Memory, which comes out in December. And currently he's putting out a new track from that every fortnight wherever you stream your music. So 2020 hasn't been all bad if we're getting a new Kevin Godley album. And perhaps most importantly, Kevin is a drummer, and we love drummers because they're just the best people.
Yeah, there are so many drummer jokes that have the opposite opinion.
So listen, thanks for joining us, Kevin. Whenever we meet somebody new, we're always interested in, you know, their first exposure to the Beatles. And you were born probably at exactly the right time to experience them, I'm guessing, near the start.
Yeah. Excuse me. I mean, it affected everybody that I hung out with in Manchester, all the teenagers. And it's really difficult to pin down exactly why. Because pop music, excuse me, I'm going to have a sweep of water while we talk. Pop music, per se, had been around for a long time already. It was something, I have a theory about them. And there were two main tribes, if you like, in those years. There was the greasers, and the Teddy Boys, and there was the more aesthetic strain of the Beat Generation coming out of the USA. And somehow the Beatles managed to sound like Greasers and Teds, but look like the Beat Generation. They combined without even knowing it. I don't think it was that obvious to them, and it was probably because they were in Hamburg and away from the basic commercial centres of pop music, but they combined something that seemed to relate to everybody at the right time with the sound that related to everybody at the right time, and the way they looked related to everybody at that time. It was just one of those extraordinary moments, a little bubble in the 60s.
And was that obvious to you at the time? Like, because you were, like, when you saw them for the first time, did that kind of confluence seem, oh my God, they've cracked a code kind of thing?
No. No. I mean, it's not that only sort of, I only realized that a few years ago.
Yes.
I think it was the fact that we were pretty young, but we were just starting to go to art college at the time. And the atmosphere at art college in the UK in the early 60s was very open and very welcoming to anything new and different. And they just sounded right. You know, the magic thing about music, regardless of what they looked like, is the good music that lasts, hits a spot. It actually touches something in you, and you never really know why. It just does. And I think people were ready for something different. There are cycles in pop music. And the sort of 50s, early 60s pop star thing had kind of come to it at the end of its cycle, and there was something very honest about the Beatles. They didn't have stage names, you know. They looked different. They played instruments that looked different. And that's all probably because their learning curve visually was probably rooted in their years in Hamburg, you know, as opposed to in London or in this country. So I don't think they were quite aware of all those things, that confluence of events that took place to incubate the Beatles. It just was who they were. But it actually hit so many things at the same time for my generation.
And when they started, you, if I have the timeline right, you were already in a band or, you know, getting interested in music and playing music?
Kind of. Yeah, but we kind of played anything.
Yeah.
We played any old shit. And it was about the same time, and they were just beginning to peak, I think, when we were at art college. And I was going around in the back of a Thames van with a bunch of other guys playing gigs all around England.
Was there kind of a momentous first listening, or was it something that just sort of gradually crept into your artistic realm?
The thing I do remember, and it wasn't really just about me, it was, I think I'd come home for the weekend and I was heading back to college, and I got back to college and I think Sergeant Pepper had just come out, and the college seemed to have stopped, and everything that anyone was doing in the sculpture room, in the live, in the live class, in the printing room, in photography, in graphic design, no one was working. They were all poring over the album cover and playing the track. Everybody.
Yeah.
So wherever you went in the college building, was a mishmash of Sergeant Pepper. It sounded like Number Nine. All playing at the same time, and everybody was reading the lyrics. It was such an artistic event.
Yes.
And I'll never forget that. It was everything paused just to experience this record.
Yeah. I think particularly with Pepper, it's something myself and Stephen have talked about before. I think that people maybe take Sergeant Pepper for granted these days. It seems that Abbey Road and the White Album get all the love, and that Sergeant Pepper is seen as this kind of, a slightly separate thing. But to my mind, to be there at that time makes a significant amount of difference to how you experience an album like Pepper.
It was. I mean, like a lot of magic albums, the effect of it wasn't instantaneous, and the understanding of it wasn't instantaneous. You just knew when you heard it that you were experiencing something revolutionary. And it made the hair stand up on your back of your neck, and you didn't quite know why. And it took a good few listens to find the elements that were familiar to you. But it was, I'm trying to imagine what it was like for them making it, and whether they knew that it was as revolutionary as it actually was.
Well, they were certainly never not cocky in a nice way. I mean, they knew they were good.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've seen an interview with Paul where he was talking about writing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Oh, no, A Day in the Life. And that line, I'd love to turn you on.
Yeah.
Where he and John looked at each other and knowingly what they were actually saying, but they put it in anyway. I don't know. They discovered a way of working where the recording studio became the fifth member of the band, if you look, and they discovered that you could paint the sound. So they did, because no one told them they could.
And although you were in art college, you also had, you were in the Mockingbirds for that period of time. And, did you think, okay, this is my in to live the Beatle life? Or, did you get any experience, or were you down in London at all, rubbing shoulders with the periphery of the scene or any of that kind of stuff?
No, because we were in Manchester. We were a Manchester, local Manchester band.
Yeah.
And we were kind of a slightly high-end R&B band more than anything else. I had no idea if it would lead anywhere. We hoped it would, and we were kind of surprised that it didn't, because we recorded most of the songs that Graham Gouldman wrote, but we never had a hit with any of them. It was people like the Yardbirds that had the hits. So poor old Mockingbirds didn't actually go anywhere. But it was a great experience, obviously. It was just good fun. And it was about sitting at the back enjoying playing more than anything else.
And were you on a circuit with other bands at the time? I'm thinking the Hollies or the Paramounts or that. Was there a circuit that you were playing?
I guess there kind of was. There was maybe half a dozen clubs around the UK that one would keep going back to. Some of them were really seedy shitholes. And you didn't really look forward to going there at all because they could get pretty violent. I think there was one club we used to play, and if you didn't play the songs they wanted to hear, they'd throw stuff at you. And some of them would get really drunk and demand coming on stage and singing. You know, it was really hairy. But some clubs were a little bit more sedate, and some of the clubs were normal. But it was mostly a club circuit. There was no really for bands like us a concert.
No.
And we eventually took a little step up in Manchester and played places like the Free Trade Hall, places like that eventually. But it was clubs, really, little tiny stages.
And at that stage, were you in a position of acting as a support band for other acts, you know, in the way the Beatles had supported, you know, American artists and things like that?
Yes, there was probably one of the most popular clubs in Manchester. It was a place called the Oasis, and they had two stages. They had an A stage and a B stage. And the B stage was our sort of natural habitat. I don't think we ever played the A stage. And it was about the size of my computer screen stage. And the toilet was about the size of an iPad. So, as was the dressing room. So it was pretty grubby and pretty grimy and pretty dirty and sweaty. But what the fuck? We were kids and we loved it.
Yeah. And did the Liverpool thing of the Beatles have any particular resonance being from Manchester yourselves? That, you know, it always seemed that they kind of broke a kind of London-centric mold, even though they all went to London pretty early themselves.
I think what it did was it gave us confidence that, you know, you don't have to be in the centre of everything to make an impact. And I suppose the obvious conclusion of that was a setting of our own studio there. I don't think without the awareness of the Beatles coming from Liverpool and being successful at Liverpool, I don't think we'd have got to that same place. Mm. But we were kids. We were in our early 20s or teens and just having a great time. There wasn't a lot of analysis going on.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Like, everybody looks back and they kind of look at the 60s as if everybody in the 60s was saying, oh, isn't it great we're in the 60s? It was just what was obviously happening at the time. Yeah. But it's more remarkable in retrospect to some degree, I guess.
Well, there were so many places to play.
Mm.
And that's what is different. I don't know, Manchester alone, there must have been about 6 or 7 places that bands could play with stages of one sort or another. And there must have been about 10 cinemas in Manchester. So, you know, you were never short of something to do when you went out in Manchester in the evening, that's for sure. It was playtime.
Yeah, yeah. And something that's interesting, because, you know, you wrote a great, I think it's a memoir more so than an autobiography, called Space Cake a few years ago. And what's interesting is, you know, you describe your childhood and, you know, it's not obvious, I think, to you maybe growing up exactly where you're going to, what you're going to do in life.
I knew what I didn't want to do.
Yes. But in some ways, you kind of look at the slipstream of everything the Beatles did, and your options as a young person between 1960 and 1970 has kind of been changed because of kind of the road that they broke through during those years. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah. I mean, I always look at it as, I mean, when we all started listening to pop music, rock music, we were kind of listening to it on stations like Radio Luxembourg. Which were crackly and, you know, really bad reception. You had to search around the dial to find them. And it was mostly stuff coming out of America, but it was calling to us in one way or another. And people like Elvis and people that were popular in the 50s and very early 60s, they kind of opened the door a little bit. But when the Beatles came along and that whole generation that followed, they booted the thing off its hinges.
Hmm.
You know, and that was exciting because suddenly it meant that pop music isn't this particular firmly designed and boxed in thing. You don't have to play by these rules anymore.
Yeah.
Because someone has been hugely successful, a group has been hugely successful by doing the exact opposite. So there are no rules anymore. And for a couple of art students, that was kind of what we were taught anyway.
Yes, yes.
So we kind of jumped in head first.
And in 1968, I think you leave art school, and you paid a visit to Apple in the initial months afterwards. Is that right?
Yeah, we did.
What do you remember from that? Was that a...
Oh, the smell of dope.
Okay.
Of hash permeated the entire building. And sitting in a waiting room with, I think it was Twiggy on one side and someone like Igor Stravinsky on the sofa with it. It was like, what the fuck is going on here? It was like a psychedelic experience, and everyone was, you know, smoking spliffs, and we were these little, you know, Manchurian teenagers. We eventually met somebody, Tony Bramwell
was his name. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I forget exactly why we were there. I think we were trying to sell a bizarre multimedia musical or something. And... yeah, it was an interesting few hours, and then we left. We were stoned, but we didn't know it. But nothing really ever came of that. I mean, that's how Apple was.
Was that in response to just the fact that Apple was putting adverts in the press saying, if you have talent, if you have a project?
Yeah, show up.
Yeah, and you literally could just show up and make a pitch. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, there was no, you know, well, Tommy's got a window at 3 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah.
you just rolled up and, you know, sat in the waiting room. People just passed by that were legends, you know. And then you got to see someone who was probably more stunned than the people in the waiting room. And you said your piece and you left your bag of stuff with them. And I don't think we ever heard from anyone. I think they're closed shortly after that.
Yeah, I think that seems to be par for the course, that you turn up, make your pitch, and that's it.
It was very idealistic, I have to say. You know, there's no business acumen.
It's a pity, really, because there's a lot of... Apple was a good idea badly executed, if you think about that multimedia landscape.
A chunk of it missing, like how to make this idealistic idea actually function as a business. That didn't exist. But we were kind of there at that sort of tipping point when it was about to cease to exist.
you kind of move towards a musical existence. Record some singles and you drift towards working in-house in Strawberry Studios.
I apologize, it's raining.
I've just had the same rain lash the windows here. I'm not sure if it's being picked up. but I guess, where was your mind at the end of the 60s in terms of, you know, because you were doing lots of different things. And were you specifically trying to, you were doing painting, you were doing music, you were playing, you were recording. Was it just that kind of art school freedom of, I'm going to do all these things? Or at which point did the... You know, did it seems you kind of lock in more on the musical side of things?
Oof. That's a big question.
Maybe that hasn't settled yet.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I remember when we actually left college, the day we left college, we drove down to London to a recording session.
Yeah.
It was for a label called Marmalade, run by Giorgio Gomelski. And we recorded one song as the horrifically named duo Frap Joy and the Runcible Spoon.
Mm.
Jesus.
It was the 60s.
You can timestamp that, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the name was almost as long as the 60s. So, we did that. And that was really exciting.
Yeah.
To be in a proper recording studio with a proper producer and proper musicians. But then again, Marmalade went bust. There's a pattern emerging here. First we go to Apple and they go bust. Then we go to Marmalade and they go bust. I think maybe we jinxed people. But we didn't really know who or what we wanted to be, because I think by then we were aware that we didn't want to pin ourselves down. I think we sensed that we could do a few different things, so why not try them all?
Mm.
The first professional job, professional, I use the word advisedly, we did a mural for our manager. That was our first professional commission. But I remember probably the most interesting thing that we did, we were asked to do a cut-out book of an 11th Hussar for Pan Books, I think it was. It was about so big. It was about 2 foot square. And the idea was you cut out these shapes, which we painted, and you slot them together, and you get a 3 foot high cardboard statue of an 11th Hussar. I think it was to promote the film Charge of the Light Brigade. And that was great fun. And that kept us up most nights. And probably, I think we were doing that and watching television live for the moon landing.
Wow.
Which was extraordinary.
Yes.
We did that, and we did lots. But the music kept drawing us back in.
And was there a sort of an underlying confidence at that time, a sort of certainty that you knew music, you know, you were going to get there in the end? Something was going to come, or were you just?
We were punting like everybody else, I think, and a lot of people doing what we were doing. But I don't know, I think you get a feel, when you've written something, you get a feeling from it.
Mm.
And the feeling we were getting was, you know, this is actually not bad. And there's probably a lot of hurdles between now and any form of success. But we've got something. And, you know, we were quite lucky. I mean, Graham used to record our initial warblings on his Revox tape recorder at home, kind of let us demo things, try things. So we were very gradually becoming a sort of very small commodity in Manchester. You know, small fish in a small pond, but fish nevertheless. And we just kept slogging on, you know, for the hell of it. But it wasn't really until the end of the 60s that we made any real impact.
Mm. Well, when you kind of look at, you know, the Hot Legs period, there's a track on that Hot Legs album, Sweet F.A., which is kind of Beatly in terms of execution.
Well, it's like Abbey Road.
Yes.
It's like the end of Abbey Road, and that, I suppose that was the inspiration.
Yes. I suppose when you're kind of... It's an interesting thing that we've talked about before, myself and Stephen, which is that there's two ways you can kind of be inspired by the Beatles. You can either try and go down a route to, you know, make something that sounds like a Beatles record. But the flip side of that is, you know, also trying to harness the kind of the imagination or the freedom aspect of what they did and the honesty of what they did. It's what's odd to me 50 years later is just how much the Beatles stuff still can resonate depending on how the wind is blowing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I've noticed, again, looking back, excuse me, I'm pouring a drink again, is that when you do make music and you're young, you can't help but in a way copy to a degree some of your favorite artists, because they are your reference points.
Yeah, absolutely.
As to what you think of music is. So when you start to write a song, it's only natural that you pull in some of these influences. And that's a very good example, Sweet F.A. You know, that was very Abbey Roadish, and then we thought, wow, it sounds like the Beatles, must be good. But gradually, over the intervening years, it's become obvious to me that when you actually stop thinking about it and you just do it, that gradually goes away, and you find that you find your own voice eventually, without even knowing it sometimes. And that's really exciting. In other words, you don't really have to think all the time. You don't have to think, well, oh, this doesn't sound like John singing. Let me have another crack at that take. That just disappears because it's not really what you're after. You're really trying to find your own musical identity. And you're using what you know and what you've already heard as a kind of stepping stone to somewhere. It's just that you don't know where the somewhere is.
Yeah. Well, you could argue even the Beatles went through a phase of that themselves, doing their Buddy Holly songs and their rock and roll songs. It happens to everyone. I always find the Strawberry Studios part of your experience, the pre-10cc period, quite amazing. I love the notion of a house band and this kind of hit factory notion. And I think when, we were talking about Apple a few minutes ago, Apple set up a studio and was supposed to make hit records, and that fell apart. And I think Strawberry Studios is what Apple Studios should have been. It seems to be like a crack squad of, really hardworking, super talented people. Is that a...
Yeah. But it was... I also think it worked because there wasn't a professional recording studio in Manchester until Strawberry came along. There was lots of wee demo studios. And it was quite a leap of faith to build it. And the first wave of people that we ended up producing were really bizarre comedians and people's girlfriends and football teams. And I was like, what the fuck are we doing for that? And sort of local orchestras and bands and stuff. But that's kind of what was going on in Manchester. Manchester wasn't perceived at that time as being a place where you went to make records. And it took quite a number of years for that perception to change. And I think we helped make that happen.
Yeah.
But, looking back again, those were great years because our influences were formed. Sort of recording comedians. I mean, where the fuck is that going to go? But you learn something from every session you do, probably the first professional musical sessions that we did. Graham, I don't know if you remember, Graham was in New York in the early days of Strawberry writing for a bunch of guys called Cazenet's Cats, churning out pop music. And they wanted to record a bunch of tracks and give them different names, all made by the same bunch of studio people. So Graham suggested, well, okay, I've got a share in this studio in London, in Manchester. Why don't we do it there? We can give you guys good rates. And they went for it. So we spent a good few months in there recording these tracks for people like the Crazy Elephant and God knows what other names, but they were all us.
Yeah. But it's so, like your Hamburg in a way, that those years.
Yeah. We learned our chops being other people.
Yeah.
And recording a strange bunch of characters. So it was like Broadway Danny Rose. It wasn't like the Broadway studio.
I mean, it's an interesting way to sort of, I know you've been in the business for years, but most people are coming at it from the point of view they're touring, they're playing live, then they come into a studio, whereas really, you're almost doing it in reverse. You're in the studio, you're learning the studio craft, you're working with other people.
Yeah.
And then that leads on to the decision to form the band. So it's very few bands sort of do it that way.
That's very true. It was just how it happened. And it all because of Strawberry. Really, we had this incubator where we could... where we just went and made music one way or another. And it wasn't until a few years into that process that, a light bulb went off.
I was going to say, was there a point at which it could have stayed that way, that it could just have become the sort of premier venue, the premier recording studio, and the band wouldn't have emerged? Or was there always that still ambition in the back of your mind?
I think it would have. It may have been a bit... It may have happened a little bit later or in a different way. But the person who actually suggested it in a very off-the-cuff way was Neil Sedaka. We recorded, again, we were the house band and producers for two albums for him. And at some point during the second album, he said, "You guys are really good. You play really well. Why don't you become a band?" And it was like, "Oh, yeah." Don't forget, prior to that, a good few years, there was Hot Legs, which was a very short-lived band. But it was like, you know, and I think that was because our main function on both those albums were as a house band as opposed to producers. It was a very simple rhythm section-led lineup of musicians. So we were playing a lot and playing together a lot. And that kind of cemented it, really. The fact that we could, as opposed to relying on recording techniques, we could actually play well together. And, you know, it's silly, really, when you think of it, but just him saying that, just, you know, a bell went off. So we did, and we, again, Apple came into the equation. The first thing we recorded was a track called Waterfall, memory serves, which wasn't brilliant. It was kind of like a Crosby, Still and Nash thing, and we sent it to Apple. what was left of Apple at the time, and they turned it down. So we knew we were on the right lines.
so that would have been 1972. That sort
something
of
something like that. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm interested that you were persisting with Apple. You know, but like by 72, Apple was in pieces.
Yeah, it was. It was.
But still, there's Beatle magic, though, in Apple.
Oh,
you know?
Exactly.
Well, I guess what happens in the aftermath of that, you know, the rest is history, that, you know, you kind of cross the Rubicon into becoming, you know, you're making hits, you're on top of the pops, and you kind of... did you find that, you know, because of your professional experience recording that... you know, getting behind the screen of fame, it wasn't that exciting, or, you know, was it everything that you hoped it would be, or was it, did you have kind of a slightly askew vision of what was happening?
No, it was pretty exciting.
I'd imagine.
I remember, just jumping back a few years, I remember distinctly a moment, and this was about Neanderthal Man being Hot Legs. We made the record and we put it out, you know, like many other things that we've done. And I'd gone on to, I don't know whether I was with Lol or not, but we were at some outdoor festival. And we woke up in the morning and everyone had their radios on, you know, all the different tents had their radios on. And I had something to go, oh, what's that? That's really familiar. What the fuck is that? And it was Neanderthal Man, and it was being played on, you know, hundreds of radios around the site. And, you know, A, it's nice to hear something of your own actually on the radio, but actually hearing it on that many radios at the same time is truly something else. It's exciting. There's no way of getting away from it.
Yeah.
First hits are always exciting. And hits are exciting with and all the hoo-ha that goes with them.
Yeah.
You do get a bit blasé about it afterwards, you know, a little bit down the line. But it still is. It always will be an exciting thing because it means a lot of people like what you do. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. So it's amazing and always will be.
And when it happened, I mean, it really happened. And it happened fast. And you know, you were churning out the hits.
Well, yes and no. It happened, and as most of these things tend to happen, they're not kind of calculated. They're virtually accidents of timing and whatnot. And our first hit at Tennessee was a track called Donna. I think it went to number two. But that was a B-side. That was the B-side of the song that we'd sent to Apple. And we wrote it in half an hour. And recorded it just to fill that slot, you know. But during the recording of it, it became obvious that this is more interesting than the A side. And it was a hit.
Yeah.
And, you know, the template was starting to be built. And then, you know, we had to record an album. We gave ourselves, we had to do it quickly because things moved fast in those days. Mm. And I think we had about 3 to 4 weeks to write and record an album, you know. This may or may not have been, you have to forgive my timeline, but it may not have been, or it may have been after we had Rubber Bullets as a hit as well. There was one in between that wasn't a hit, mm-hmm. called Johnny Don't Do It, because we were trying to build on the success of Donna. So we did another sort of doo-wop pastiche that didn't work. So we thought, oh, fuck it, let's just do what we like. But as I said, we had about 3 weeks to record an album, and that harks back to what I was saying earlier. There wasn't time to consider everything, to think, well, that doesn't sound like it's, you know, like what we really like. There was only time to write stuff and record it and see what happened. So the brain was disengaged, but everything else was functioning. It was all about feel and instinct and intuition, that first album.
Yeah.
And it was something that was different to what was going on because of that.
You kind of have to work hard to get to a place of automatic creation in a way. You know, it's, I think Hemingway said about going bankrupt, it happens slowly and then all of a sudden, you know. I'm assuming fame is like that, and some of the best ways of working can be like that as well.
Yeah, the thing is never to take it for granted. Mm. Never to get to a place where you begin to believe that you've found the perfect key to who you are and what you are. Bring a napkin around my neck, because I was eating before you came up. Always trust the process, but never assume that the most recent process is the one you're going to stick with forever.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that happens in that kind of run between 72 to 76 is you overlap with Paul McCartney, and he's in Strawberry making the fantastic McGear album. Me and Stephen love the McGear album. We think it's one of these little gems. Was that your first direct interaction with a Beatle, or had you crossed paths at any other point?
No, not that I can recall.
People are very strange about meeting McCartney, where they, it seems it's, you know, you want to be normal, but you can't be normal, or, you know, how did it land with you?
Well, you know, you're seeing album covers, you're not meeting anyone, you're seeing album covers.
Yeah.
But he was lovely, you know, he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
So, and we were in a working environment. And how it worked was we'd work up to about sort of 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and then he and Mike would come in and take over the night shift. So there was a point of crossover where we played each other stuff, you know, which was kind of cool.
Hmm.
But, you know, it's when you meet someone you admire, you always do feel a bit, whoa. But he makes you feel comfortable, you know.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say. Yeah,
and I suppose as you say, he was on your territory. You know, it was a work environment, and by that stage, you were in one of the biggest bands in the UK at that time yourself.
Yeah, so, that's right. So I wouldn't say we were equals.
No, but you were established, and you had that that position. So
yeah. That's right. And we obviously both appreciated each other's work very, very much, which was great.
Mm.
And did you say you were sort of playing each other things, but he didn't pick up a guitar and play, or didn't ask you to come and play on the gear?
I can't remember how their sessions actually worked. I'm probably wrong, or I may be wrong. I'm not sure whether they'd already written stuff and they were just recording it.
Yeah.
But they had a pretty tight schedule, I think. So, you know, there was maybe an hour when we got to play a couple. You know, he plays a couple of things on 24 track that they were recording, and we do the same. Mm. We didn't actually play.
Sure.
It was just sharing bits of tapes and snatches of things that we were both working on at the time.
Well, as Jason said, both he and I are very fond of that McGear album. I think it's almost like a lost McCartney album. And sounds, I don't know if you've heard the reissue of that, and there's a remaster, but it sounds fantastic. I mean, it's a great advert for Strawberry Studios. I mean, it sounds amazing.
Yeah. It had a good sound. It was a good vibe. It was in the walls.
Yeah. That's the stuff you can't plan. I suppose as we progress through the 70s, there's the kind of the cleaving of 10cc and Godley and Cream is something I know you've talked about a lot in interviews and documentaries and all the rest. I guess to look at it a different way, with the benefit of hindsight, do you have any insight into when the Beatles split up? I kind of feel that the Beatles were at the vanguard of so many things, and they were probably the first band to split up that people were kind of curious about the afterlife. And the older I get, when I was a kid, I was like, why do they have to split up? The older I get, the more I realize, listen, families don't talk to each other. People go away. People fall apart. I'm much more forgiving about these things. But
yeah.
Is there anything of the psychology of that you can give us as someone who is in a famous group?
Only to a degree. Mm. I mean, I guess the Beatles had achieved everything they set out to achieve and 100 times more.
Yeah.
So there was nowhere else. There was nothing that they wanted to do together or hadn't done together. So I guess there were
no mountains left to climb.
I guess. No, I mean, it was. If they did, it was just repeating themselves. So it was kind of like they'd run out of steam, I think, like any relationships do.
Yeah.
I don't think we split up because the Beatles split up, or any other band split up because the Beatles split up. I think it's a natural thing. Things come to an end. And when we split up, I don't think it was that different, really. I don't think we hit the heights that we wanted to.
Mm.
We did okay. It was just, you know, you're right, I've spoken about it many, many times. But just briefly, it was about the fact that the two main pulses, the two main creative pulses of me and Lord Cream and Graham and Eric, were kind of thinking about things in a slightly different way. And me and Lol, being art student boys, wanted to keep disrupting, whereas the other two wanted to keep working on stuff that they felt would work. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We wanted to keep searching for new things. And that's why we split up. But the weird thing is that we didn't have to.
Mm.
That is the bizarre. I'm glad we did, looking back, because we wouldn't have had all the other many adventures if we had stuck together. But there was no real reason why we had to. You know, we could have gone off and done our little solo project, learned some stuff, and then come back. If it still didn't work, then we'd go our separate ways. But, you know.
Well, I think in some ways there wasn't much of a precedent at the time for this kind of stuff. I mean, nowadays you have, say, someone like Damon Albarn or somebody who's able to weave in and out different projects, and it's all good, you know?
Yeah.
But I think back then it was to do with more of an artistic purity. It's an all or nothing type thing.
Yeah.
That kind of take is what happens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the only wisdom I can offer.
There was an interview you gave where you said that the band at the time was not democratic or smart enough to sort of encompass that way of working. And it seems to me that that's a phrase that could be applied to the Beatles in 1970, that mm-hmm. as Jason said, there was no template for that. Now it's a common thing for people to go off, do their own projects, come back, coalesce, split.
It's you know, that particular business, in a way, hadn't matured to that level. And I don't think attitudes have matured to that level and understood that was possible. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think Jason was right when he said that it was an all or nothing thing.
Mm.
You know, like the Three Musketeers, we stick together. and if we can't do that, then fuck you. but it wasn't that. It was more that we just couldn't face doing another album if we knew exactly what the album was going to sound like. if you know what I mean. It was starting to head towards that kind of a template. We have to have a funny one. We have to have a long, complicated one. We have to have a lurve one, you know.
Yeah.
That wasn't what made it exciting in the first place.
Yeah.
So we were still young. We had other things we wanted to do.
And was there always that pull to the visual side of things at that stage?
Not as much. I think Godly and Cream songs were always very visual.
Mm.
And I think that's partially because we always saw ourselves as something other than musicians, or something as well as musicians, and that one day maybe we want to end up behind a camera shooting something or other, because we came from a visual background and we missed that to a degree.
Yeah.
So we came out in the music.
Yeah.
And we had a very definite, distinctive way of looking at making music, which had no business component attached to it. It was a purely creative exercise. Whereas I think with the other two, there was that, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing or a wrong thing, but they had an idea of, or a sense of what 10cc was about and should continue to be about. Whereas we didn't agree with it.
Well, I suppose is that idea of the sort of traditional songwriting, I mean, I'm not using the phrase Tin Pan Alley in a pejorative way, but there's that sort of traditional songwriting side, and then there's the art school side with the visual aspect. And as you say, that idea of disruption, that if you get something, then you dismantle it and you head somewhere else, or you throw the pieces up in the air and see where they land.
That's right. That's right. And we'd had a good few hits by then. So, you know, there was pressure, if you like. You know, we had people working for us. We had management. We had management. Mm. We had a road crew. We had responsibilities. So perhaps that sense of daring had been eroded a little bit, you know, as it does.
One of the obsessions at the time was the Gizmotron, which is, you know, a fascinating object. And Paul McCartney uses one on his London Town album. Was that something you had to sell him on directly, or did he call you up and say, I need a Gizmotron? Or
I can't remember. I think we had, I mean, if the Gizmotron, or the Gizmo as we called it back then, existed during the Hot Licks album sessions.
Mm.
I think that's where it came about. And we had one kind of lashed together. We had a prototype made by the College of Science and Technology in Manchester. And I think it was permanently strapped onto one of Lol's guitars. So he may have tried it on the Might Be Gear sessions.
Right.
I can't remember. Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
I guess how did it end up? How did Paul McCartney end up playing one on his album? It's a very, you know,
what
it's
year
a
great. Was the album?
It was 78.
It's on I'm Carrying on London Town.
And we may have. I'm trying to remember when the production version of the Gizmotron came out. It may have already been in production by then, and if so, that's probably what it was. If not, he probably borrowed Lol's guitar.
I was going to say, this is where we find he stole it and never gave it back or something. Really.
But it's great. I mean, a number of artists used it. I mean, Jimmy Page used it. Susie and she's used it.
It's the introduction to In Through the Outdoor in the Evening, isn't that?
Yeah.
A Gizmotron,
But that must be a thrill that, you know, to be able to hear your work.
It's brilliant.
That way.
Unfortunately, it didn't sell very many because the timing was shit.
Mm-hmm.
It hit the market when cheap synthesizers were coming out. And as you probably know, it was kind of very vulnerable.
Tricky,
If, you know, the heat in the room would change it, the air pressure would change it. You couldn't rely on it to sound like an orchestra.
But there's so many things I've seen, so many ideas you've had over the years, which seem to be ahead of their time. Like the Gizmo seems like a kind of a Kickstarter idea back in the 70s, you know?
Yeah.
You can imagine. somebody coming up with
it now. I think it's because I was born prematurely. So I've either been trying to slow things down or speed things up to catch up. I don't know. But yeah, that does happen. We have done and still continue to come up with ideas that are ahead of the time, which is kind of satisfying in a way, but not if people don't understand what the hell they are.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Der neue Peugeot 308, jetzt mit markanter neuer Lichtsignatur. Als Hybrid, Plug-in-Hybrid oder voll elektrisch. Bis zu 450 Kilometer Reichweite. Und mit integriertem ChatGPT-Assistenten.
Hallo, wie kann ich helfen?
Jetzt kommt der Löwe. Der neue Peugeot 308. Ab 239 Euro monatlich leasen, ohne Anzahlung. Jetzt bei deinem Peugeot-Händler informieren.
Well, as we progress through your career, you know, yourself and Lol Cream move into the video industry. And that kind of happens, am I right in saying that kind of happens by accident through an Englishman in New York, that it wasn't necessarily on the roadmap?
Yeah. All the good things do.
Good.
We had an Englishman in New York out as a single, and we weren't a touring band, so we couldn't gig. So we thought, well, okay, let's make a little film. And I'm trying to remember what outlets there were for little films. There was, I think,
Was Kenny Everett on the air at that point? Kenny Everett, I'm kind of thinking of that kind of...
Kenny Everett, yeah. The old Grey Whistle Test.
Yeah.
You know, these little kind of boutique shows that were on the time occasionally played music videos, but they weren't called that then. They were called anything. And so we shot up at the label with this sort of 8-frame storyboard for Englishman in New York. And I said, okay, yeah, let's do it. But you can't direct it. You've never done it before. So we have to get a director in. They got a guy called Derek Burbage, who was the director who did, I think he did the first 3 or 4 promos for The Police. And so we were just the artists, really. But we kept our eyes and ears open all day. And we were looking at each other all the time going, this is fucking brilliant, this stuff. What's that? It's a camera. Oh, my. What's he doing now? Oh, wow, okay. We were soaking up, assimilating this experience, which, whether we knew it or not, we've been waiting all our lives for. Particularly when we insisted on being there during the edit, we kind of started to take over, embarrassingly. But Derek was very sweet about it. I think he sensed that it was important to us. And let us try everything, you know. What happens if you press this button? Don't press that button. What happens if you wiggle this and turn that? And, you know, the old disruptive thing was coming into play again. But we learned a lot on for that one video.
Yes.
And so what happened was, when it actually came out, right about the same time, Steve Strange, who we knew, just formed Visage, and he insisted that we direct his first music video because he knew us. And most of the other people who were directing videos at the time weren't remotely connected to the music business at all. And so he felt comfortable talking to people who were other musicians. And as you say, the rest is history. And I think that's part of why we did quite well, because we understood music.
Yes.
The inner life of the music, rather than just, you know, the ABC of putting an idea on film.
But I do like early on how you're very much about, you know, playing with the form, pushing tricks in on the camera. Like, one of my favorite early ones is the Wide Boy video, which isn't very well known, I don't think. But there are so many, and I hope you know what I mean by this, kind of the analog aspect of it, of the trickery in it, that it's so much fun. It's really clever and thought out, but it shows a different way of thinking to the other kind of clips of the time.
I think one of the things that we realized very early on in what you might call a career it's pointless trying to do what everybody else is doing. Mm. It's, you know, because most of the time they can do it better than you because they have more experience. So the thing was, and it's what we learned doing the first 10 CC albums, if you just think of things you want to see, there's always a way to make it happen. And it doesn't matter if anyone's not done it before, because that's actually quite cool if you're going to be the first. So figure out a way of making it happen. If you can see it in your mind's eye and you know it looks good and you trust your own taste buds, then just do it. And thankfully, in the early days of music video, there was no jury that had to, no marketing jury that had to assess your idea over seven other people who put in.
But I heard you talk about this before, that with music video, you kind of got in on the ground floor, or maybe with pop music, there'd already been formed there.
That's right. We were at the beginning of it, so we molded it to a degree.
Yeah. And that must be a different kind of thrill, because the making it up as you go along aspect of it is totally different to, you know, where there's a pop music form when you're making the pop music.
Yeah, it is different. I mean, with music, it's easy.
Yeah.
To a degree. I mean, technically it's easy because it's just you and the studio and whatever team you've got around you. If you're making any kind of film and it's different and you want to see things differently, then you have to talk to your director of photography, the sound guy, the wardrobe, the art director. There's all these components that you have to bring into your vision to make it work. So there are many other people's taste buds to factor into the process, which makes it a lot more difficult. It's a more difficult process. But we were lucky. We found a bunch of people who liked our ideas and helped us to make them as close to the original concepts as possible.
Mm. And so with success in the music video realm, the Beatles come knocking, and we really want to talk about The Cooler, which is a very odd little thing. We want to talk about it for about 3 or 4 hours, if that's okay with you.
We were in Los Angeles at the time when we got The Cooler. I don't remember what the hell we were doing there. We may have been filming The Police, Synchronicity, or not Synchronicity, Wrapped Around Your Finger, or something like that, when we got a call, to do... And I think it was Paul who called us.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it's a Ringo song, but it's produced by Paul, it seems. It's an MPL project.
Well, there are three songs.
Three songs. So, what was the brief, or what was the, like, did you write it, or were you given the ideas by Paul or Ringo, or what was?
I think what happened was, you know, obviously let's listen to the tracks. Mm. And we usually started like that. But then we had to think of some kind of way of wrapping the whole thing up into a little short film. So we came up, and, you know, we knew that Ringo loved acting and loved playing around. Mm. So we just wanted to give him a vehicle that would work as a kind of way of gluing all these things together.
So just,
and we just
came
up with this idea, like a prison escape thing, which was pretty cool.
So for people who are listening that won't necessarily have seen The Cooler, this is Private Property, Attention, Sure to Fall, three songs off the Stop and Smell the Roses album, which was Ringo's 1982 album.
Yeah.
Paul is heavily involved in that. But this project comes sometime after the album has been released.
I don't remember that. I can't remember the timeline. But
the album I think comes out late 81, and then this is filmed in 1982.
Oh, okay.
So it's one of the first, I suppose, I was going to say high profile projects, you know, but you've got McCartney and Ringo Starr together, which would be one of the sort of first times that they'd worked
bit
together for quite a while.
A bit of a coup.
Yeah.
I remember it was a lot of fun actually doing it.
Well, you had Linda and Barbara back, and it was...
Yes. Crazy. I mean, looking back, we should have done it on location.
Yeah.
We ended up building all these
So, I was going to say, it has a particular look. I mean, it does have a sort of a look, a sort of almost, I want to say almost like a spaghetti Western look.
It has a very Western kind of look.
The one you're hoping for is cheap. I don't know why we did that. I think it was, after having many discussions with production and understanding what our budget might be, we all kind of came to the conclusion that we could build all this stuff in the studio and not have to worry about weather and things like this, because it wasn't a day shoot. It was probably 2 or 3 day shoot. But it was quite limiting in a way. The studio wasn't quite big enough to get satisfying crane shots of the prison gates opening and moving towards the back of the truck and all. It was a little bit compact, shall we say.
I have to say it does look as if it was a lot of fun to do.
It was hysterical.
I watched it last week in preparation for this, and it's got a great charm to it, and it's always just fun to see Paul and Ringo larking, basically.
Oh, I know.
And it ends up at the Cannes Film Festival.
No way, really?
Yeah. There's a MPL put out a sort of a promotional description, and it said a new mini film produced by MPL Communications called The Cooler recently entered in the short film category in the Cannes Film Festival in May.
It is a short, like sort of best used of faux Nazi uniforms.
Yeah, you like the description. It says it is a short musical psychodrama starring Ringo Starr, Barbara Bach, Paul and Linda, set in a prison camp policed entirely by women somewhere, sometime in the future. What's not to love? What's not to love?
Exactly.
But it's, for listeners to the podcast who haven't seen it, it's all up in its glory on YouTube.
It's very of its time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little time capsule. It's great. But as Stephen said, it's kind of, particularly in that tragic, you know, in the aftermath of John's death, it's interesting to see the two of them together, and it's one of the first things that kind of comes out after his death, and I think it's good fun.
We didn't even shoot it on film. We shot it on video for some reason.
Yeah.
Which probably adds to the character, but...
reduces the cost.
Great. It doesn't look that great. It does look very of its time.
But a few years later, I'm guessing the budget was a bit bigger for When We Was Fab, which is another video you're involved in.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, Ringo's on the scene. And... When We Was Fab, when I read your book, Space Cake, you certainly describe very well how music videos move towards your own particular vision. And then after the years, it becomes, as you say, a market driven, you're almost told what to do. I'm guessing When We Was Fab was very much, you know, your idea pitched to George. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what was that process like? Was that an easy video to imagine or to put together, or because it's not a retro video? It could have been a retro video, but it's not. It's a very striking, clean kind of setup for that video.
I mean, I think probably the biggest problem we had with our ideas not just this particular video, was that there was no such thing as digital video. Everything was still analog. So with anything that involved layers of things going on, every time you added a new layer, you lost quality. And blue screen or green screen, that particular technique wasn't as sophisticated as it should have been. So there was always nasty lines and things around the edges of people. We kind of went ahead and did it anyway. But it could have looked so much better. But, I don't know. We didn't feel like we were trying to do something, or we should be trying to do something more traditional, because at the time, I think George had had a few solo hits of his own anyway. He sort of broken out as a solo artist. So this was just one of a string of George Harrison tracks, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
So we just had this slightly bizarre idea of him standing against the wall and growing various extra limbs, if you like, And I think it was because it was kind of a slightly psychedelic idea, which is what the song is kind of about, harking back to yes. those years. And it kind of worked. The thing that was most difficult were those things towards the end where we have rocking buildings and George is against the wall and then he lifts his legs up and he's sort of hanging in space and becomes like an Indian image, a multi-limbed Indian image. But nevertheless, it actually turned out rather well. So looking at it now, it looks, the actual quality is a bit shabby. But as you say, that sort of gives it something of its time.
I was going to say that sort of grainy, that sort of look is sort of integral to the
whole thing. Oh well, if you're saying that, we obviously
absolutely.
It was totally designed into the original idea. Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. But it absolutely pitch perfectly ticks so many boxes with the sort of Beatles, you know, the Sergeant Pepper uniform and the apple and all of those things. It just ticks so many. It's a beautiful thing.
It's again, it was a fun day. We had a good laugh. Everybody enjoyed it very, very much. Elton John.
Yeah, can I ask a question? Did Paul Simon just happen to be wheeling a cart past the studio and you
Paul
got into
contact?
Is Paul Simon in the video? You're going to tell us Paul Simon isn't in the video.
Oh, where do you see Paul Simon?
All of the commentary talks about Paul Simon being in the video.
He's the guy pushing the cart. That's what people think.
The guy pushing the cart?
One of the wipes is a guy pushing a cart from across the screen. And there's a core group of people online who think that person is Paul Simon.
I've never met Paul Simon.
You heard it here first.
We were both pretty stoned in those days. So it's possible, but yeah. No, I don't remember. Why do they say it's Paul?
They get carried away because they can see Elton John and Neil Aspinall is in it.
He's probably Ringo. I mean, there are layers of things happening.
Yeah.
Paul Simon?
I can't. Yeah, this is a.
Does it look like Paul Simon?
Not really. It is if you're told it is, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
Who said it was?
We're just looking at various sort of commentary online about this, and it's in several places that the people are in the video. It's, you know, it's George, it's Neil Aspinall, it's Elton John, and Paul Simon.
Well, that's a no from
that's
Mr.
No
Godley.
This is
from the director's mouth, but as the caveat being that we were a bit stoned.
The thing I remember at the time, I remember very well that video coming out, and certainly I have to admit, it was many years later I saw a picture from the set, and I realised that there was that it was done by superimposing George's head. I didn't realise that at the time, so I certainly didn't see the join back in the day.
No, we didn't superimpose his head.
Was there not a thing of superimposing George's head? Am I totally wrong? Was there not parts of it, or there was a body made that he stuck his head into? Was it? Or how did it work?
Oh yes, that's right. I think he stuck his head through the wall, and there was a prosthetic. Not for all the shots, though. I'm just trying to remember. I think for a lot of it, he's actually there playing the guitar, mm-hmm. and there are holes in the wall with arms coming through behind him.
Yeah.
But there may have been a prosthetic version of it where he had to stick his head through the wall. Wow, you're digging deep.
Well, one of the things I remember at the time when the video came out was this big hubbub that it was supposed to be Paul, George, and Ringo playing together. And obviously, Paul McCartney, we assume, is not in that walrus costume in the background.
No, it was our manager.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Was that I'm wondering, you know, one of the things we've learned about reading a lot about the Beatles and doing this podcast is that there's an awful lot of politics around the Beatles world. And I'm wondering, you know, was this project, did you get a sense of that kind of political nature of them as an entity?
Not at all, no.
Really? Okay.
No. If we had it, then we'd have walked away. No, we didn't. It was just we had a very specific idea. I remember that we we storyboarded in quite a lot of detail,
yeah,
because it was important. And we just filmed it, and everyone was very accommodating. I don't remember anything political, nothing that was apparent on set.
And was that George that approached you, or his people approached you to say, we'd like you to...
What's that? I can't remember.
Hmm.
Honestly, sorry,
I appreciate we're just obsessively poring over this. It's very embarrassing that we're doing this. But
No. I remember that we visited George at his house, Friar Park. I think we went there to talk about it, but I can't remember who got in touch to sort of offer us the job. Because it was different, you know, mostly it's the label or a manager or something like that. But
was that your first contact with George? Is that the first time you'd met George, or?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Paul Simon wasn't there at that time.
I think we've conclusively shown that Paul Simon is not there.
We're going to have to get Paul Simon on the podcast to confirm this.
Probably said he was.
There is another rumor online about that video amongst the Beatle fandom. Beatlemania is a nice way of putting it. Obsessiveness is another way. Is that Paul McCartney is hidden in the video, that he's the wobbly man who wipes across the screen. But I'm sure you're going to burst our bubble and say that he's
nowhere near that
video. Yeah. Yeah, the drunk guy, yeah.
No, that was an extra.
There we go. Jeez. See, we're just, this is the level of detail I know that people will say, you didn't ask Kevin Godley who the individual people were in the video.
Move on.
Any of those early news conferences that Bob Dylan did?
Oh, yeah.
It's a bit like that, isn't it? Where people are asking, you know, why did you wear that T-shirt with the motorcycle thing?
That's it.
Got a photograph taken for Highway 66. It's nine. It was just what I was wearing on the day, man. It's like, you know, people want their heroes to be super normal or super abnormal.
Well, I think sometimes fans forget that people are working and they're doing a job and they're getting it done, and it's, you know, their relationship with the art is different to the artist's relationship to the art. I think a lot of fans totally miss the point on that.
Yeah.
Not everything has a hidden meaning.
No. Paul Simon is.
I fear we've ruined your day.
I have to immediately go and check the video.
That's what I'm
pushing the fruit cart. Right?
Yeah.
The fruit cart guy.
We're all going to go and check the video.
If we're staying on the video theme, you then, you know, you've done a Ringo video, you've done a George video, you do a Paul video in the early 90s,
yeah,
you do Come On
was,
People.
That was great. I've actually been doing this series on Instagram. I've been putting up stills from a lot of the videos that I made. And that was one of them.
Yeah.
What was it called?
It was Come On People was the song.
Come On People, yes. That was a very interesting project. Again, it was something that I wanted to try that actually worked, combining two different speeds activity in one shot. It was quite difficult to...
And is that a digitally controlled camera you're doing that with?
Yeah, motion control.
Yeah.
It's called motion control. It's a computer-driven camera crane. So you can program it to do a move, and it would repeat that move.
Hmm.
Whatever you put actually in the same shot. But in this case, it was a matter of changing the camera move to accommodate time-lapse situation as well as a real-time situation. So it's quite complex.
It still looks very good today because it's, one way of doing it would have been obviously to get Paul to sing really slowly and he's sped up as well. But instead you actually get this very... It's still a very striking effect between the fast and the regular motion.
Like that.
Is that more rain, is it?
Have you got that as well?
No, the rain has stopped in Dublin.
We've got yours.
Sorry about that.
Belfast's fine.
Jesus.
That's not good.
It was a couple of days, probably 2 days shooting. We went really late on the last day.
Yeah.
But again, we it was in a big studio. I think we shot it at Ray Studios. But grateful. It's funny. I did a little anecdote about it in the Instagram thing. There's a shot towards the end where Paul's playing and he goes, he kind of points off camera. He's pointing at me because I think I just tripped over a wire.
Yeah.
I'm sort of writing around and I sort of fell over the wires. That's what actually happened.
One of the things I've just realized we missed out in the chronology was Paul appears on a Godley and Cream album. He sings on, is it Get Well Soon?
Get Well Soon,
yeah.
How did that happen?
We just thought it'd be kind of cool. You know, it's one of those kind of pipe dreams. Wouldn't it be cool?
Just stick them on.
Sang backing vocals on that track. Yeah. Well, why don't we ask him? What? Why don't we ask him? All right, well, that's, you know, there's no fucking way. But there was a way. And he said, yeah, okay. Yeah. And we showed up for an afternoon and sang.
It sometimes is that simple. Asking is the first step to getting any of this stuff done,
yeah,
really, isn't it?
It's brilliant. I mean, you know. When you get to that stage in life and you get one of your all-time heroes to actually perform on one of your songs, it doesn't get any better.
Yeah, yeah. But all roads kind of lead to the big project, which is actually directing a Beatles video, the Real Love video. And yeah. That's
I call it the Threetles.
The Threetles,
yes. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did you... You know, it seems the anthology project, you know, there's an awful lot of back and forth between the Threetles themselves. And was it the fact that you'd worked with each one of them individually before that, you know, you ticked the box three times, or how did it end up becoming something you got involved in?
I'm trying to remember the chronology of this. There was another project I did for Paul, and I can't recall if it was after this or before it. He was touring...
It was 93. It was before. You did the tour film. Yeah.
Yeah, when I did a pre-stage film for them. So when was Real Love?
Was 95.
So in other words, we worked together a few times before. We knew each other. Mm. At the time, we were neighbours as well.
Ah.
So, yeah, we lived reasonably close to each other. And I think that they'd already had a hit with the previous song, which was that very, it was beautiful.
Free as a bird.
Sort of flying camera that went into elements of from their past. And they wanted to do something this time that was a little more documentary based and using archive footage. It was, again, a thrill, obviously. And the archive footage was brilliant. You could really get the sense that they were really enjoying what the hell was happening to them. However ridiculous it got and outrageous it got, they found ways to have fun with it. And that was so clear on the footage. They were having a ball.
So this is the video camera footage that you got, is it, of the three of them in the studio? No.
You mean
what was the series they did at the time? They did a very big series, a retro series, The History of the Beatles.
Anthology.
Yeah.
And we had access to some of that footage.
Okay.
And there's quite a bit of that footage in it, alongside the fly on the wall stuff of the studio. I wasn't there for that. By the way, this was stuff that was being filled anyway. My role was really to come up with a bit of glue, if you like, visual glue, which was, I took the idea of Yoko's original film of John in super slow motion and had the other three do it as a kind of link. But there was another few things like the John's white piano rising up out of the Mersey and some Beatle memorabilia floating through the air. I don't know. I just kind of felt that yes, of course it can be archive-based and documentary-based and have that kind of fly-on-the-wall vibe about it, but you can't really do anything about the Beatles without some magic.
Yes.
something magical, something, I don't like the word psychedelic particularly, but something that's reminiscent of that. So that's creatively what I brought to it. And the rest was just archive, and then just playing around in the edit. There is an embarrassing story about the edit, mm-hmm. that we were given a mix to work with, and the record wasn't actually out yet, I don't think.
There was a lot of secrecy at the time.
There was. Mm. And the mix was a rough mix, and John's voice was very low in the mix. And it wasn't a good listen. You know, being a musician, when I'm working to a piece of music, I like to hear the music. And this, it wasn't all there.
Yeah.
So to make it clear for me, just for the purposes of the edit, as a workaround, I went into a little sound studio and sang over the top of John, just so I could hear the fucking song. and then we worked to that.
Yeah.
And somehow it got leaked onto the internet. Hmm. So it's out there somewhere, you know, John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Kev.
We'll have to go looking for that.
Yeah, you will. I'm sure you will.
But that would have made you one of the first people to hear those Threetle reunion songs. That's a heavy burden if you don't like it, or if you think, I don't want to.
I didn't hear them. I only heard that one.
That one? Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. But you know what, Buzz?
Absolutely.
What a thing. You know, I John was the only one that I never met. Mm. Obviously met the others, both in their solo incarnations and as three. But it's one of those moments in your life that you kind of cherish.
So did that project bring you face to face with the three of them at the same time, or were you kind of working in isolation?
No, they were all. I filmed them all separately.
Yeah, because those bits are lovely where you interstill with you intermix with the John.
Yes.
They're absolutely stunning.
That was just a matter of, it kind of feels like they're in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was just a matter of finding shots that made that idea work, or coming across them and then thinking, oh, if I make that happen before there, it looks like John's looking at Paul or whatever. Mm. I mean, those things are quite simple. It's just deciding which shots to use is just part of the editing process.
And
it was an editing process probably more than anything else.
And were you given a sort of a relatively free hand in how it was put together? Or was there, I mean, one of the things that we, Jason and I have talked about before, about the whole anthology project, is this idea of the compromises that the three individuals are making in putting the team together. So George gets Jeff Lynne as the producer, Paul gets Jeff Emmerich, who is his man, and then George gets someone else who is his man. And arguably, you're the one person that all three of them would have ticked the box to say, yes, we're all very happy with him, because you'd worked with them all before.
I guess. I never thought of it like that. I didn't actually know what you just told me.
Yeah,
I mean, the whole Jeff as well. Did they have three Jeffs?
Well, maybe that was it. Maybe that was it. The whole project is a compromise in like picking.
Right.
Mark Lewis, and the author, has described it as children picking a team in a playground. You know,
right.
But it did occur to us. Jason and I were talking before this and saying that you're probably the one person involved in that project that had the confidence of all three of them. Having worked with them all before.
I never thought of that, but that is lovely. Hmm. That is lovely.
So I know we're taking a lot of your time, but we might bring it up to date, because I know you've got a new album coming out called Muscle Memory in December. Yeah. And when we were kind of going through bits and pieces before this, one of the quotes you have is that you've said technology is the new Beatles. That's a thing I've heard you say before. And I know that technology,
quote. I'm not sure what it means, but it's not bad.
I think it's in the terms of, you know, it's just this notion of being at the vanguard of creativity, and you know, technology is that tool we have now. And I know in terms of your new album, you know, you've used technology to to work with musicians from around the world. And again, this was another idea you might have had before its time, because I know you did One World, One Voice years ago, and this is a version of this that's kind of being pulled right up into 2020.
Yeah, I think it's because I'm a drummer, and you know, the traditional songwriting process for most of my life has been sitting opposite somebody who can play a proper instrument. And while they play, I mumble and warble and write notes and sing. So my only other musical tool, apart from drums, is singing. But it's very difficult to do that on your own. So, and a couple of, I assume you're going to ask me, what the process was?
Yes, I suppose you should tell us what the process was. I'm being very mystical here.
No. It was because of something, again, one of those random things that happened. A couple of people, totally unrelated to each other, I don't know, over a period of about 6 months, sent me two pieces of instrumental music and asked if I'd be interested in writing and performing a song over them. In other words, composing something and singing it. And I'd never done that before. So I tried it, and it worked really well. It was like sitting opposite to somebody, but they'd already written it, and they weren't badgering me for a cup of coffee every 10 minutes. So it worked, and it was enjoyable, and there was nobody I had to answer to particularly. So I recorded it. I used GarageBand and recorded these two songs and sent it back to them, and they both thought they were great. They've actually both songs have ended up on the album. But I kind of figured when that thing hit me about, well, it'd be nice to make an album. I haven't made any proper music for a long, long time. Hmm. If you are going to make an album, you do want to write songs, why not do it this way? But open the idea up to include everybody and anybody, not just professional musicians, in quote marks. Because the tools for making music were and still are very readily available and cheap nowadays. A lot of records are made on a laptop. So people who you wouldn't expect to be able to make music can make music, and in many cases, far more exciting music than those you would expect to be making exciting music, because, there's another layer of rule-breaking. Mm. So that's what I did, and I did it through a site called Pledge Music, which essentially were a crowdfunding site, but you pledge to buy a record but also do a Q&A with me or get a t-shirt or come to an event or appear in a video, something like that. The purpose of doing that was to raise a small budget for me to actually finish the record once I got past demo stage, but unfortunately Pledge Music went bankrupt. So I had to start all over again. I had the songs by me, or most of them. So I joined a small UK label who kind of found me and found this idea and really liked it and invited me to join their label. They're called State 51 Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And we've got a great relationship. It's a very creative and constructive relationship. But they've been releasing the album, should we say, in a kind of episodic way. They've been putting tracks out every 2 weeks with a view to releasing the finished thing over 4 months. I think it's on December the 17th. So it's more like a sort of TV series, if you like, because they're all little stories. Building up to the binge box set on December the 17th. It's been great fun. I really, again, earlier in this discussion, I mentioned about finding your own voice. I found another voice doing this, my own personal voice, without the encumbrance of having to answer to anybody else.
It's the best of both worlds in a way, because you get to collaborate and you get to do your own thing. It's kind of perfect.
Yeah, and I've never met any of these. I've met one of them before. One of my collaborators was Gaucher.
Oh, yes.
But the others, I've had phone conversations with them, and, you know, obviously a lot of emails going backwards and forwards, but I haven't met them.
That's fantastic. I mean, I have to admit, you know, when Expecting a Message came out, that was the first one that came out, and it was kind of Spotify, I think, just nudged me in the direction of it. And I was like, oh, Kevin Godley's got new music. And yeah, to actually hear you sing again, and for it to have been so darn good, it's a bit of a thrill. It's
I've got great. A new one up today, actually. A new track up today.
Okay.
Thank you. That's nice to hear.
And I guess there's still, it's... You're very much a pro technology guy, though. I mean, I think some people tend to go, well, sure, if everybody can record stuff, it's no good. But talent still rises. The good stuff still is good, irrespective of how it's made. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's always been like that, really. Whatever the technology is, you know, probably before there was any technology, and people just played stuff, you know, the good stuff did rise to the surface because it was good. You know, people just find it.
Yeah.
And there is still good stuff out there. I think the biggest problem with technology is that there is so much stuff out there. It is in a way difficult to sort the wheat from the chaff.
Mm. There's no boredom anymore.
There's no what?
There's no boredom anymore.
No, but we are very spoiled.
Mm.
We're very spoiled. So if we don't like something in the first 10 seconds, we can click a button and go and listen to something else. You know, there is the sort of dark side of that coin.
It's the attention. It's the attention span. No one has any attention span anymore.
No, we obviously do.
Well, we do. We do.
Yeah.
We do.
All souls.
But I mean, that is kind of weird, and that's a challenge. I kind of don't dwell on that. I'm just looking at the technology as there's extra tools for the toolbox to get stuff out there, I guess.
Mm.
It's as long as it doesn't become technology for technology's sake.
Oh, good. It couldn't.
And that's never been the case with what you've done. You're sort of seem always to be pushing slightly ahead of the technology, and the technology is catching up with some of the things that you
were. I don't know about that, but one thing I found is I never thought most of the stuff I do. Traditionally, I'd like to sort of sit back and, you know, tell an engineer to add more bass, or let's take two frames off that cut and move it 3 seconds later. I've learned how to do all that now. I've mastered, to a degree, GarageBand, which isn't the hardest piece of audio technology there is, but I used it to do all the vocals for the album. And I've learned how to edit video. I now use Adobe Premiere Pro at home. And I found, to my surprise, that I'm getting relatively instinctive about, you know, what to do, what buttons to press. Occasionally something disastrous happens, you know, I wipe something that's taken 15 hours to do. But it's not a major catastrophe anymore. I know how to fix it. So I've learned a number of skills by deciding to get involved in technology that I didn't think I'd be able to do. So and that's basically come about because of this album. I'm come about because of the disastrous collapse of Pledge Music. Mm. I kind of figured that I have to do this at home.
Mm.
You know, I didn't have a budget to go and make it yet, so I've got to kind of finish the vocals at home. So I did, you know.
It is interesting. Years ago, I used to play with like an old Tascam four-track tape machine. And I remember when GarageBand came out going, oh, this is phenomenally sophisticated, and it's free.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
It's crazy. The only one thing I haven't figured out to do yet, which everybody else has, is how to play something.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of the things that annoys me about technology. The assumption the instructions have that you know that bit that they've left out.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, you have to press that there. You didn't say that, you bastard.
There's parts of my day job that are to do with technology interactions, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And
Exactly. The assumption that you're as smart as they are.
The assumption that it's obvious what has to happen is frustrating.
A bit patronizing, isn't it? but yeah, I mean, technology is brilliant. I mean, it's got its downside.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a song on the album, I don't know if you won't have heard it yet because it's not been released yet, but it's called One Day. And it's based on the idea that in the future, if not already, there will be software that will allow some technological company to purchase an artist's entire recorded catalogue, all their recordings that they've ever made, feed it through this machine that will examine, analyse, at granular level, what actually makes it work. And then at the press of the button, spit out a new track without the artist having to lift a finger or sing anything. It's just using what already exists to create something new. Mm. And that wouldn't surprise me if that was actually happening.
Well, I can tell you that it is happening.
Oh, no.
I have heard an AI assimilation of the Beatles, and it is horrific because it's not a proper song, because the thing doesn't know what a song is, but it's this wave of noises that is basically, they've fed all the Beatles music into a computer and they said, okay, now AI this into a song, and it's like trying to remember a dream. It's like a really nightmarish scenario.
I love the fact that it sounds terrible. I love the fact that, well, it's basically disrupted the Beatles, hasn't it? It's a piece of machinery.
But they'll get there eventually. I'm pretty certain of it, you know?
Well, it's like the sort of, supposedly the positive side of deep fakes. but I think it's a horrible idea. But then again, I'm vintage.
Well, it's odd, the kind of things we get used to, isn't it?
True enough.
Yeah. Well, look, Kevin, I think we've taken up an awful lot of your time. Thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It was quite fun.
And I hope we haven't stressed you out about whether Paul Simon was in George Harrison's video or not.
While you're on, I'm going to look at it.
Oh, okay.
Just
director's commentary.
When we was fab. There can't be many things called that, can we?
No.
When we was... lyrics cause meaning cameo. Cameos, hang on a minute. Ringo Starr, Elton John, Jeff Lynne, is he that? Don't remember that.
He's one of the violin players.
Neil Aspinall, holding a copy of John Lennon's 1971 Imagine album. I don't remember that easy. I did say we were stoned at the time, didn't I? I'll just get the video up and scroll through it. Okay, so I'm looking for, this is Kevin Godley commenting on it. I'm looking for a guy going by with a
fruit and veg cart.
There's a bit where he walks away from the wall. And there is Jeff Lynne. Yeah.
The microscopes that magnify the teeth, studying once and all. Still alive, but we are.
I missed it. Oh, there it is. Looks a bit like him, actually. Hang on a minute. I understand why. No, it's an extra. I'm sure. I think it's an extra.
That's fantastic.
We'll just edit that so that we just hear you saying it looks a bit like him, and we just
you bastards!
We'll cut that.
You're going to keep the conspiracy theory alive.
Yeah.
You know, and what he's actually wheeling is Art Garfunkel.
You should always print the legend, you know?
Yes. Let me look at that again. How weird. Nah, I don't think so. I would have remembered if it was if it was fucking Paul Simon.
You would. Well, look, Kevin Godley, thank you so much for talking to us today. Best of luck with muscle memory and everything else that you have in your future. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully when all this is over, we'd be happy to buy you a cappuccino or a pint or whatever it is your tipple these days.
Oh, I want a lot more than that. I want Paul Simon to serve me. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay,
brilliant. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
So that was Kevin Godley there talking to us a little earlier in the month, and we're very, very glad that he took the time to talk to us. That was a pretty good chat, wasn't it, Stephen?
That was something else. I can't believe we had Kevin Godley on the program.
It was very nice. He was very generous with his time, and it really is fascinating when you kind of look back on you know, his 50 plus years of all the things that he has managed to weave his way in and out of. And he's all very modest about it. He's not, it's as much a surprise to him as to anyone else.
Yeah, if I were Kevin Godley, I'd be telling everybody I was Kevin Godley.
Yeah, if I you're exactly right. I'd be like, don't you know who I am? That'd be my catchphrase. Yeah. But he was absolutely fantastic to talk to, and we're very, very grateful. And of course, once again, don't forget, folks, Kevin has a new album out in December, and unfathomably, it's his first ever proper solo album. It's called Muscle Memory, and he's already released some tracks on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your music already, and they're well worth checking out. But the full album drops in December, Muscle Memory from Kevin Godley, and it's worth checking out. You've heard some bits and pieces from it, have you, Stephen?
I have. I've been listening to the singles. Yes, excellent stuff.
Excellent stuff. So again, thanks to Kevin Godley, and thanks to you all for listening. As per usual, we remain available in all the normal places. We're on Twitter at Beatles Pod. We have the Facebook group, which Stephen will let you in if you knock very politely on the door and say swordfish. And we're also available online in other corners if you go looking for us as well. We appreciate all nice reviews that you leave wherever you download your podcasts. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.